another? Is it because of the qualities of a leader? Is it due to a process the leader and follower engage in? Does it occur because of the circumstances? I believe all of those factors can come into play. Based on my observations and personal experience, here are the top five ways that leaders gain others' respect. Number one, natural leadership ability. Some people are born with greater skills and ability to lead than others. All leaders are not created equal. If you possess natural leadership ability, people will want to follow you. They will want to be around you. They will listen to you. However, one of the greatest potential pitfalls for natural leaders is relying on talent alone. Number two, respect for others. Dictators and other autocratic leaders rely on violence and intimidation to get people to do what they want. That's not really leadership. In contrast, good leaders rely on respect. They understand that all leadership is voluntary. When leaders show respect for others, especially for people who have less power or a lower position than theirs, they gain respect from others. And people want to follow people they respect greatly. Number three, courage. One thing that caused everyone to respect Harriet Tubman so much was her tremendous courage. She was determined that she was going to succeed or she was going to die trying. She didn't care about the danger. Her mission was clear, and she was absolutely fearless. Good leaders do what's right, even at the risk of failure, in the face of great danger and under the brunt of relentless criticism. Number four, success. Success is very attractive. People are naturally drawn to it. People respect others' accomplishments. And it's hard to argue with a good track record. When leaders are successful in their own endeavors, people respect them. When they succeed in leading a team to victory, then followers believe they can do it again. As a result, followers follow them because they want to be part of success in the future. Number five, loyalty. We live in an era of free agency. Professional athletes hop from team to team looking for the best deal. CEOs negotiate ridiculously high financial packages and then bail out as millionaires when things go wrong. The average worker, according to one source, will change occupations 10 times by the time he reaches age 36. In a culture of constant change, turnover, and transition, loyalty is an asset. When leaders stick with the team until the job is done, remain loyal to the organization when the going gets tough, and look out for the followers even when it hurts them, followers respect them and their actions. If you want to measure how much respect you have as a leader, the first thing you should do is to look at who you attract. The second thing you should do is to see how your people respond when you ask for commitment or change. When leaders are respected and they ask for commitment, their people step up and sign up. They are ready to take risk, charge the hill, put in long hours, or do whatever else is necessary to get the job done. Likewise, when respected leaders ask for change, followers are willing to embrace it. But when leaders who are not respected ask for commitment or change, people doubt, they question, they make excuses, or they simply walk away. It's very hard for a leader who hasn't earned respect to get other people to follow. In October of 1997, college basketball saw the retirement of a great leader, someone who engendered respect as he spent more than 30 years of his life pouring himself into others. His name is Dean Smith, and he was the head basketball coach at the University of North Carolina. His leadership not only won games and the respect of his players, but also helped produce a remarkable 49 men who went on to play professional basketball. Included in that list are greats such as Bob McAdoo, James Worthy, and of course, Michael Jordan. Not only one of the best players ever to dribble a basketball, but also a fine leader in his own right. Michael Jordan understood what it meant to follow a good leader. During the waning years of his career, he was adamant about his desire to play for only one coach, Phil Jackson, the man he believes is the best in the business. It made sense. A leader like Jordan wanted to follow a strong leader, one stronger than himself. That's the law of respect. It's just possible that Jordan's desire got its seed when the young North Carolinian, still developing, was being led and mentored by his strong coach, Dean Smith. If you ever become frustrated because the people you want to follow you are reluctant to, it very well may be that you are trying to lead people whose leadership is stronger than yours. That creates a difficult situation. If you're a 7 as a leader, 8s, 9s, and 10s aren't likely to follow you, no matter how compelling your vision is or how well thought out a plan you devised. So what can you do about it? Become a better leader. There's always hope for a leader who wants to grow. People who are naturally a 7 may never become a 10, but they can become a 9. There's always room to grow. And the more you grow, the better the people you will attract. Why? Because people naturally follow leaders stronger than themselves. Law number 8, the law of intuition. Leaders evaluate everything with a leadership bias. Because I'm a communicator and do a lot of public speaking, people occasionally want to hear from my wife, Margaret, and she gets invited to speak at an event. As the date approaches, Margaret works on her presentation and puts together her notes, but we inevitably end up having a conversation something like this. "John, how do you think I should start?" she asks. "It depends," I answer. "That's not much help." "Margaret, I'm not trying to be difficult. Every speaking situation is different." "Okay, but what would you do?" "Well, I'd go out and talk to many of the attendees before the event started to try to get a feel for who they are. You know, just check out the room. And I've listened to what the host said and to the people who spoke before me to get an idea if I should play off something they said that happened earlier. I'd find a way to really connect with the audience." "That doesn't help me," she answers in frustration. To be honest, her questions frustrate me as much as my answers frustrate her. I have a hard time explaining what I would do because communication is intuitive for me. It's one of my greatest strengths. Now, I'm not picking on Margaret. She's more highly talented than I am in so many areas. To give you an idea, when I'm getting ready to speak at an event and I'm trying to pick out my clothes, I'm worthless. One of two things usually happens. I stand in the closet paralyzed and drooling, totally incapable of figuring out what goes together, or I pick something out, put it on, go into the bedroom, and Margaret says, "Oh, John, you're not going to wear that, are you?" Well, of course not," I answer. "What do you think I should wear?" At that, Margaret strolls into the closet and looks around for about 2 seconds. "I haven't seen you in this jacket yet, so how about this," she says as she starts grabbing things, "and if you wear this shirt, this tie, it will really pop." As she picks the slacks, I try to be helpful and pick out shoes. "No, you can't wear those shoes with this," she says. "Here, wear these with this belt." When I'm at the event, I hear compliments about how I'm dressed, so when I return home, I hang the whole outfit together in the closet because I know it goes together. Then the next time I get ready to leave for a speaking engagement, I put it on and walk confidently in the bedroom. Margaret says, "You can't wear that again," and off we go through the whole routine one more time. You see, people born with natural leadership ability are especially strong in the area of leadership intuition. Others have to work hard to develop and hone it. But either way, intuition comes from two things: the combination of natural ability, which comes in a person's areas of strength and learned skills. It is an informed intuition, and it causes leadership issues to jump out to a leader in a way that they don't with others. I regard leadership intuition as the ability of a leader to read what's going on. For that reason, I say that leaders are readers. Leaders are readers of their situation. In all kinds of circumstances, leaders pick up on details that might elude others. They tune in to leadership dynamics. Many leaders describe this as an ability to smell things in the organization. They can sense people's attitudes. They are able to detect the chemistry of a team. They can tell when things are humming and when they're winding down or getting ready to grind to a halt. They don't need to sift through stats, read reports, or examine a balance sheet. They know the situation before they have all the facts. That is a result of their leadership intuition. Leaders are readers of trends. Most followers are focused on their current work. They think in terms of task at hand, projects, or specific goals. That is, as it should be. Most managers are concerned with efficiency and effectiveness. They often possess a broader view than employees thinking in terms of weeks, months, or even years. But leaders take an even broader view. They look years, even decades ahead. Their intuition tells them that something is happening, that conditions are changing, and that trouble or opportunity is coming. Leaders must always be a few steps ahead of their best people, or they're not really leading. They can do that only if they are able to read trends. Leaders are readers of their resources. A good worker encounters a challenge and thinks, "What can I do to help?" A high achiever asks, "How can I solve this problem?" A peak performer wonders, "What must I do to reach the next level so that I can overcome this?" Leaders see a challenge, problem, or opportunity, and they think, "Who is the best person to take this on? What resources, raw materials, technology, information, and so forth do we possess that will help us? What will this take financially? How can I encourage my team to achieve success?" Leaders see everything with a leadership bias. Their focus is on mobilizing people and leveraging resources to achieve their goals rather than on using their own individual efforts. Leaders who want to succeed maximize every asset and resource that they have for the benefit of their organization. For that reason, they are continually aware of what they have at their disposal. Leaders are readers of people. President Lyndon Johnson once said that when you walk into a room, you don't belong in politics if you can't tell who's for you and who's against you. Reading people is perhaps the most important intuitive skill leaders can possess. After all, if what you are doing doesn't involve people, it's not leadership. And if you aren't persuading people to follow, then you're not leading. Leaders are readers of themselves. Finally, good leaders develop the ability to read themselves. Leaders must know not only their own strengths and blind spots, skills and weaknesses, but also their current state of mind. Why? Because leaders can hinder progress just as easily as they can help create it. In fact, it's easier to damage an organization than it is to build one. We've all seen excellent organizations that took generations to build begin falling apart in a matter of years. Whenever leaders face a problem, they automatically measure it and begin solving it using the law of intuition. They evaluate everything with a leadership bias. For example, leadership intuition came into play in the recent years at Apple Computer. Just about everybody knows the success story of Apple. The company was created in 1976 by Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak in a garage. Just 4 years later, the business went public, opening at $22 a share and selling 4.6 million shares. It made more than 40 employees and investors millionaires overnight. But Apple's story hasn't been all positive. Since those early years, Apple's success, stock value, and ability to capture customers have fluctuated wildly. Jobs left Apple in 1985, having been pushed out in a battle with CEO John Sculley, the former Pepsi president whom Jobs had recruited in 1983. Sculley was followed by Michael Spindler in 1993 and then Gilbert Amelio in 1996. None of them was able to reestablish Apple's previous success. In its glory days, Apple had sold 14.6% of all personal computers in the United States. By 1997, sales were down to 3.5%. That was when Apple again looked to the leadership of its original founder, Steve Jobs, for help. The failing company believed he could save it. Jobs intuitively reviewed the situation, and immediately he took action. He knew that improvement was impossible without a change in leadership, so he quickly dismissed all but two of the previous board members and installed new ones. He made changes in the executive leadership, and he fired the company's ad agency and held a competition for the account among three firms. He also refocused the company. Jobs wanted to get back to the basics of what Apple had always done best, use its individuality to create products that made a difference. At the time, Jobs said, We've reviewed the roadmaps of new products and axed more than 70% of the projects, keeping the 30% that were gems. Plus, we're adding new ones that are a whole new paradigm of looking at computers. None of those actions was especially surprising, but Jobs also did something that really showed the law of intuition in action. He read Apple's situation and made a leadership decision that went absolutely against the grain of Apple's previous thinking. It was an incredible, intuitive leadership leap. Jobs created a strategic alliance with the man whom Apple employees considered to be their arch enemy, Bill Gates. Jobs explained, "I called Bill and said Microsoft and Apple should work more closely together, but we have this issue to resolve, this intellectual property dispute. Let's resolve it." They negotiated a deal quickly, which settled Apple's lawsuit against Microsoft. Gates promised to pay off Apple and invest $150 million in non-voting stock. That cleared the way for future partnership and brought much-needed capital to the company. It was something only an intuitive leader would have done. Apple's stock value immediately went up 33%, and in time, Apple regained some of the prestige it had lost over the years. In 2001, Jobs made another leadership move based on his intuition. While other computer manufacturers were pursuing PDAs, he was looking at music. And when an independent contractor and hardware expert named Tony Fadell approached Apple with an idea for an MP3 player and a music sales company, Apple embraced it, even though several other companies had rejected it. Fadell was hired on, and they began working on what would eventually be known as the iPod. Jobs' involvement with the iPod is an indication of his leadership intuition. Ben Knowles, who was on the inside of the project, said, "The interesting thing about the iPod is that since it started, it had 100% of Steve Jobs' time. Not many projects get that. He was heavily involved in every single aspect of the project. Why did Jobs do that? Because his intuition as a leader made him understand the impact that the device could make. It was consistent with his vision for creating a digital lifestyle." Jobs has been right on. Sales have been phenomenal and have exceeded the company's computer sales. Apple was making a profit while other technology companies suffered. By spring of 2002, Apple had shipped more than 10 million units. By the end of 2005, Apple possessed 75% of the world's market for digital music players. Jobs' story is a reminder that leadership really is more art than science. The principles of leadership are constant, but the application changes with every leader and every situation. That's why it requires intuition. Without it, leaders get blindsided, and that's one of the worst things that can happen to a leader. If you want to lead long, lead well, and stay ahead of others, you've got to obey the law of intuition. Law number 9, the law of magnetism. Who you are is who you attract. Effective leaders are always on the lookout for good people. I think each of us carries around a mental list of what kind of people we would like to have in our organization or department. Think about it. Do you know who you're looking for right now? What is your profile of perfect employees? What qualities would they possess? Would you want them to be aggressive or entrepreneurial? Are you looking for leaders? Do you care whether they are in their 20s, 40s, or 60s? What will determine whether the people you want are the people you get, whether they will possess the qualities that you desire? You may be surprised by the answer. Believe it or not, who you attract is not determined by what you want. It's determined by who you are. In most situations, unless you take strong measures to counteract it, you draw people to you who possess the same qualities that you do. That's the law of magnetism. Who you are is who you attract. When I was a kid, my mother used to tell me that birds of a feather flock together. I thought that was a wise saying when I was spending time with my older brother Larry and playing ball. He was a good athlete, so I figured that made me one too. As I grew up, I think I instinctively recognized that good students spent time with good students, people who only wanted to play stuck together, and so on. But I don't think I really understood the impact of the law of magnetism until I moved to San Diego, California, and became the leader of the last church that I pastored. My predecessor at Skyline Church was Dr. Orville Butcher. He is a wonderful man with many admirable qualities. One of his best is his musicianship. He plays piano and has a beautiful Irish tenor voice even today in his 80s. At the time I arrived in 1981, Skyline had a solid reputation for fine music and was nationally known for its outstanding musical productions. In fact, the church was filled with talented musicians and vocalists. Why were there so many exceptional musicians at Skyline? The answer lies in the law of magnetism. People with musical talent were naturally attracted to Dr. Butcher. They respected him and understood him. They shared his motivation, his values. They were on the same page with him. Leaders helped to shape the culture of their organizations based on who they are and what they do. Music was valued. It was practiced and performed with excellence. It was used to reach out to the community. It was deeply ingrained in the culture of the organization. In contrast, I enjoy music, but I am not a musician. After I came on board at the church, the number of new musicians arriving at the church declined quickly. But do you know what kind of people started coming instead? Leaders. I valued leadership, modeled it, trained people in it, and rewarded it. Leadership was woven into the fabric of the organization. By the time I left Skyline, not only was the church filled with hundreds of excellent leaders, but the church had raised up and sent out hundreds of leaders. The reason was the law of magnetism. Our organization became a magnet for people with leadership ability. If you have recruited and hired a staff, you will probably find that you and the people who follow you share common ground in several of these key areas. Generation. Most organizations reflect the characteristics of their key leaders, and that includes their age. During the dot-com boom of the 1990s, thousands of companies were founded by people in their 20s and early 30s. And who did they hire? Others in their 20s and 30s. In just about any type of organization, most of the time, the people who come on board are similar in age to the leaders who hire them. Often that occurs within departments. Sometimes it occurs company-wide. Attitude. Rarely have I seen positive and negative people attracted to one another. People who view life as a series of opportunities and exciting challenges don't want to hear others talk about how bad things are all the time. I know that's true for me. And not only do people attract others with similar attitudes, but their attitudes tend to become alike. Attitude is one of the most contagious qualities a human being possesses. People with good attitudes tend to make people around them feel more positive. Those with a terrible attitude tend to bring others down. Background. One of Theodore Roosevelt's memorable accomplishments is his daring charge up San Juan Hill with the Rough Riders during the Spanish-American War. Roosevelt personally recruited that all-volunteer cavalry company, and it was said to be a remarkably peculiar group of people. It was comprised primarily of two types of men, wealthy aristocrats from the Northeast and cowboys from the Wild West. Why? Because Roosevelt was an aristocratic-born, Harvard-educated New Yorker who turned himself into a real-life cowboy and big-game hunter in the Dakotas of the West. He was a strong and genuine leader in both worlds, and as a result, he attracted both kinds of people. People attract and are attracted to others of similar background. Blue-collar workers tend to stick together. Employers tend to hire people of their same race. People with education tend to respect and value others who also are well-educated. This natural magnetism is so strong that organizations that value diversity have to fight against it. Values. People are attracted to leaders whose values are similar to their own. Think about the people who flocked to President John F. Kennedy after he was elected in 1960. He was a young idealist who wanted to change the world, and he attracted people with a similar profile. When he formed the Peace Corps and called people to service, saying, "Ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country," thousands of young, idealistic people stepped forward to answer the challenge. It doesn't matter whether the shared values are positive or negative. Either way, the attraction is equally strong. Think about someone like Adolf Hitler. He was a very strong leader, as you can judge by his level of influence, but his values were rotten to the core. What kind of people did he attract? Leaders with similar values, all utterly evil men. The law of magnetism is powerful. Whatever character you possess is what you will likely find in the people who follow you. Energy. It's a good thing that people with similar levels of energy are attracted to one another, because when you pair a high-energy person with a low-energy person and ask them to work closely together, they can drive one another crazy. The high-energy person thinks the low-energy one is lazy, and the low-energy person thinks the high-energy one is insane. Giftedness. People do not go out looking for mediocre leaders to follow. People are attracted to talent and excellence, especially in their area of giftedness. They are most likely to respect and follow someone who possesses their kind of talent. Business people want to follow bosses with skill in building an organization and making a profit. Football players want to follow coaches with great football talent. Creative people want to follow leaders who are willing to think outside the box. Like attracts like. That may seem pretty obvious. Yet I've met many leaders who expected highly talented people to follow them, even though they neither possess nor express value for those people's giftedness. As you listen to this chapter, you may find yourself in one of two situations. You may be saying to yourself, "I'm not crazy about people I'm attracting. Am I stuck with my situation?" The answer is no. If you are dissatisfied with the leadership ability of the people that you are attracting, then embrace the law of process and work to increase your leadership skill. If you want to grow an organization, grow the leader. If you find the people you attract to be unreliable or untrustworthy, then examine your character. Developing stronger character can be a more difficult road, but the payoff is huge. Good character improves every aspect of a person's life. On the other hand, you may be saying, "I like who I am, and I like the kind of people I attract." That's great. Now take the next step in effective leadership. Work at recruiting people who are different from you to staff your weaknesses. If you don't, important organizational tasks are likely to be overlooked, and the organization will suffer as a result. An organization will never fulfill its potential if everyone in it is a visionary or if everyone is an accountant. It is possible for a leader to go out and recruit people unlike himself, but those are not the people he will naturally attract. Attracting people unlike yourself requires a high degree of intentionality. To succeed at it, people must believe in you, and the vision you share must be compelling. Who you are is who you attract. That is the law of magnetism. If you want to attract better people, become the kind of person you desire to attract. Law number 10, the law of connection. Leaders touch a heart before they ask for a hand. There are incidents in the lives and careers of leaders that become defining moments for their leadership. In the perception of followers, the general public, and historians, those moments often represent who those leaders are and what they stand for. Here's an example of what I mean. I believe the presidency of George W. Bush can be summed up by two defining moments that he experienced during his time of office. The first moment occurred early in his first term, and it defined that entire term in office. Just 4 days after the collapse of the World Trade Center towers, Bush went to ground zero. He spent time there with the firefighters, police officers, and rescue workers. He shook hands. He listened. He took in the devastation. He thanked the people working there and told them, "The nation sends its love and compassion to everybody who's here." Reports said that the spirits of the tired searchers lifted when the president arrived and started shaking hands. Cameras captured Bush standing in the wreckage with his arm around firefighter Bob Beckwith. When some members of the crowd shouted that they couldn't hear him, Bush called back, "I can hear you. The rest of the world hears you. And the people who knocked these buildings down will hear all of us soon." The people cheered. They felt validated. They felt understood. Bush had connected with them in a way no one had seen him do prior to that moment. The second incident came during Bush's second 4 years in office, and it defined that second term. It occurred on August 31, 2005, just 2 days after the landfall of Hurricane Katrina. After the levees in New Orleans broke and the water flooded into the city, instead of visiting the city as he did in New York after 9/11, Bush flew over New Orleans in Air Force One, peering through one of the jet's small windows to see the damage. To the people on the Gulf Coast, it was a picture of indifference. After the worst of the tragedy was over, no matter what President Bush said or how much help he provided, he was unable to regain the people's confidence and trust. He had failed to connect with the people. He had broken the law of connection. For leaders to be effective, they need to connect with people. Why? Because you first have to touch people's hearts before you can ask for their hand. That is the law of connection. All great leaders and communicators recognize this truth and act on it almost instinctively. You can't move people to action unless you first move them with emotion. An outstanding orator and African-American leader of the 19th century was Frederick Douglass. It's said that he had a remarkable ability to connect with people and move their hearts when he spoke. Historian Leron Bennett said of Douglass, "He could make people laugh at a slave owner preaching the duties of Christian obedience, could make them see the humiliation of a black maiden ravished by a brutal slave owner, could make them hear the sobs of a mother separated from her child. Through him, people could cry, curse, and feel. Through him, they could live slavery." Good leaders work at connecting with others all the time, whether they are communicating to an entire organization or working with a single individual. The stronger the relationship you form with followers, the greater the connection you forge, and the more likely those followers will be to want to help you. I used to tell my staff, people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. They would groan because they heard me say it so much, but they recognized that it was true nonetheless. You develop credibility with people when you connect with them and show that you genuinely care and want to help them. And as a result, they usually respond in kind and want to help you. How do you connect? Whether you're speaking in front of a large audience or chatting in the hallway with an individual, the guidelines are the same. Communicate with openness and sincerity. People can smell a phony a mile away. Legendary NFL coach Bill Walsh observed, "Nothing is more effective than sincere, accurate praise, and nothing more lame than a cookie-cutter compliment." Authentic leaders connect. Know your audience. When you work with individuals, knowing your audience means learning their names, finding out about their histories, asking about their dreams. When you communicate to an audience, you learn about the organization and its goals. You want to speak to what they care about, not just what you care about. Live your message. Perhaps the most important thing you can do as a leader and communicator is to practice what you preach. That's where credibility comes from. Plenty of people out in the marketplace are willing to say one thing to an audience, but to do something else, they don't last. Go where they are. As a communicator, I dislike any kind of barrier to communication. I don't like to be too far from my audience or too high above them on stage. And I definitely don't want any physical barriers between me and the people. But a person's method of communication can also be a barrier. Whether I'm speaking from a stage or sitting across from someone in my office, I try to speak the other person's language to go to that person. I try to be attuned to others' culture, background, education, and so on. I adapt to others. I don't expect them to adapt to me. Focus on them, not yourself. If you go on an elevator with me and ask me to tell you the secret to good communication before I got off the next floor, I'd tell you to focus on others, not yourself. That is the number one problem of inexperienced speakers, and it is also the number one problem of ineffective leaders. You will always connect faster when your focus is not on yourself. Believe in them. It's one thing to communicate to people because you believe you have something of value to say. It's another thing to communicate with people because you believe they have value. People's opinion of us has less to do with what they see in us than it does with what we can help them see in themselves. Some leaders have problems with the law of connection because they believe that connecting is the responsibility of the followers. That is especially true of positional leaders. They often think, I'm the boss, I have the position, these are my employees, let them come to me. But successful leaders who obey the law of connection are always initiators. They take the first step with others and then make the effort to continue building relationships. That's not always easy, but it's important to the success of the organization. A leader has to do it no matter how many obstacles there might be. I learned this lesson in 1972 when I was faced with a very difficult situation. I was moving to Lancaster, Ohio to accept the leadership of a church there. It was going to be a big step up in responsibility for me. And before I accepted the position, I learned that the church had just gone through a big battle relating to a building project. Heading up one of the factions was the number one influence in the church, a man named Jim. I also heard that Jim had the reputation for being negative and somewhat of a maverick. He liked to use his influence to move the people in directions that didn't always help the organization. Because the previous leader of the church had faced opposition from Jim more than a few times, I knew that I needed to win him over. Otherwise, I would always have conflict with him. If you want someone on your side, don't try to convince them. Connect with him. That's what I determined to do. So the first thing I did when I got to my new position was to make an appointment to meet Jim in my office. Jim, I said, as he sat in my office, I know you're the influencer in this church, and I want you to know that I've decided I'm going to do everything in my power to build a good relationship with you. I'd like to meet with you every Tuesday for lunch at the Holiday Inn to talk through issues. While I'm the leader here, I'll never take any decision to the people without first discussing it with you. I really want to work with you. But I also want you to know that I've heard you're a negative person. I continued, and that you like to fight battles. If you decide to work against me, our guests will just have to be on opposite sides. And because you have so much influence, I know that you'll win most of the time, at least in the beginning. But I'm going to develop relationships with people and draw new people to this church. This church will grow, and someday I'll have greater influence than you. But I don't want to battle you, I confided. You're 65 years old right now. Let's say you've got another 10 to 15 years of good health and productivity ahead of you. If you want, you can make these years your very best and make your life count. We can do a lot of great things together in this church, I summed up, but the decision is yours. When I finished, Jim didn't say a word. He got up from his seat, walked into the hall, and stopped to take a drink at the water fountain. I followed him out, and I waited. I didn't know whether he was going to dress me down, declare war, or tell me to take a hike. After a long time, Jim stood up straight and turned around. When he did, I could see that tears were rolling down his cheeks. And then he gave me a great big bear hug and said, "You can count on me to be on your side." And Jim did get on my side. As it turned out, he did live another 10 years, and because he was willing to help me, a young kid with a vision, we accomplished many positive things together. But it never would have happened if I hadn't had the courage to try to make a connection with him that first day in my office. One of the companies I admire is Southwest Airlines. The company has been successful and profitable while other airlines have filed for bankruptcy and folded. The person responsible for the initial success of the organization and the creation of its culture is Herb Kelleher, the company's founder and current executive chairman of the board. I love what Southwest employees did on Boss's Day in 1994 because it shows the kind of connection Kelleher made with his people. They took out a full-page ad in USA Today and addressed the following message to Kelleher. Thanks, Herb, for remembering every one of our names, for supporting the Ronald McDonald House, for helping load baggage on Thanksgiving, for giving everyone a kiss, and we mean everyone, for listening, for running the only profitable major airline, for singing at our holiday party, for singing only once a year, for letting us wear shorts and sneakers to work, for golfing at the Love Classic with only one club, for out-talking Sam Donaldson, for riding your Harley-Davidson into Southwest headquarters, for being a friend, not just a boss. Happy Bosses Day from each one of your 16,000 employees. A display of affection like that occurs only when a leader has worked hard to connect with his people. Don't ever underestimate the importance of building relational bridges between yourself and the people you lead. There's an old saying, to lead yourself, use your head. To lead others, use your heart. That's the nature of the law of connection. Always touch a person's heart before you ask him for a hand. Law number 11, the law of the inner circle. A leader's potential is determined by those closest to him. When we see any incredibly gifted person, it is always tempting to believe that talent alone made him successful. To think that is to buy into a lie. Nobody does anything great alone. Leaders do not succeed alone. A leader's potential is determined by those closest to him. What makes the difference is the leader's inner circle. Lance Armstrong is one of the most talented athletes on the planet. Because of his physical gifts, he has been called a freak of nature. His sport, cycling, is perhaps the most grueling. The Tour de France, which he has won an astounding 7 times in a row, has been compared to running 20 marathons on 20 consecutive days. Clearly, Armstrong is in a class that few others can approach. His determination is unquestionable. His training regimen is unmatched. His talent is extraordinary, yet without a team, he would not have won a single tour title. Cycling is truly a team sport, though it may not seem that way to the casual observer. During his Tour de France run, Armstrong had an incredible team. Anchoring the team was Chris Carmichael, his coach, and Johan Brunel, an ex-cyclist who functioned as the team's sports director and master tactician. Both men were indispensable, since Armstrong tended at first to follow his own less efficient training regimen and execute his own tactics, causing him to lose badly. But once those two inner circle members were in place, Armstrong began to maximize his gift. Lance is the first to say he would have never won the Tour de France without the help of his teammates, explains the Team Discovery website. Every other rider sacrifices individual glory at the race in order to work for one rider, Lance, which says a lot considering what's at stake. Yet over the years, Lance delivered every single time following the work of his team, so it goes hand in hand. If the team sacrificed itself and Lance didn't have what it took to come through in the end, we would have to rethink the plan. Leaders have to deliver. There is no substitute for performance. But without a good team, they often don't get the opportunity. Their potential is determined by those closest to them. That is the law of the inner circle. In recent years, people in the business world have rediscovered the significance of teams. In the 1980s, the buzzword in business circles was management. Then in the 1990s, the emphasis was on leadership. Now in the 21st century, the emphasis is on team leadership. Why? Because nobody does everything well. I would have loved to compile fewer than 21 laws of leadership. But when I boil leadership down to its essence, I still see 21 things a leader must do well to lead effectively. However, at the same time, I also recognize that no single leader can do all 21 things well. That's why every leader needs a team of people. As Mother Teresa observed, you can do what I cannot do. I can do what you cannot do. Together, we can do great things. That is the power of the law of the inner circle. Most people create an inner circle of people. However, they are usually not strategic in doing so. We naturally tend to surround ourselves with either people we like or people with whom we are comfortable. Few people give enough thought to how those closest to them impact their effectiveness or leadership potential. You see it all the time with certain athletes who transition to the professional ranks and entertainers who achieve success professionally. Some self-destruct and never reach their potential, and it can often be attributed to the kind of people they spend their time with. To practice the law of the inner circle, you must be intentional in your relationship building. As you consider whether individuals should be in your inner circle, ask yourself the following questions. 1. Do they have high influence with others? One key to successful leadership is the ability to influence the people who influence others. How do you do that? By drawing influencers into your inner circle. That's what I did with Jim at the church in Lancaster, Ohio, whom I wrote about in the Law of Connection. Jim was the single most influential person in the organization when I arrived. By building a relationship with Jim and taking him into my inner circle, I was doing two things. First, I was exerting my influence on him, sharing my values, vision, and philosophy of leadership with him. I wanted him to be a carrier of the vision to other people in the organization. Second, I was finding out what he thought. If he had questions or objections to what I wanted to do, I was able to find out about it immediately and work through it with him. And because he had so many years of experience with the people in the organization, he often helped me to navigate around potential landmines I knew nothing about. 2, do they bring a complementary gift to the table? Because of my leadership gifting, I naturally attract leaders, and I'm also highly attracted to leaders. But one of the best things I have done in my leadership career is to bring a few key people into my inner circle who possess strengths in my areas of weakness. One of those people is Linda Eggers, my assistant. I advise young executives that their first and most important hire should be their assistant. In Linda, I have an absolute gem. She has been working with me for 20 years. She has an incredible mind for detail. She is tireless, and like Radar O'Reilly from MASH, she has the ability to anticipate what I need before I realize it. What's more, she now knows me so well that she can speak to others on my behalf, knowing how I would answer questions at least 90% of the time. 3, do they add value to me and to the organization? I discussed in the Law of Addition how people add, subtract, multiply, or divide when it comes to others. The people in your inner circle must be adders or multipliers. They should have a proven track record as assets to the organization. There is a poem by Ella Wheeler Wilcox that my mother used to recite to me when I was growing up. There are two kinds of people on earth today, just two kinds of people, no more, I say, not the good and the bad, for 'tis well understood the good are half bad and the bad are half good. No, just two kinds of people on earth, I mean, are the people who lift and the people who lean. Look only for lifters for your inner circle. Inner circle members should also add value to you personally. That's not selfish. If they have a negative effect, they will hinder your ability to lead well, and that can hurt your people and the organization. 4, do they positively impact other inner circle members? I'm a big believer in team chemistry, and if your inner circle is going to work together and function as a team, then you need to take into account how members interact. First, you want them to have a good fit with one another. Just as members of a championship basketball team have complementary skills and compatible roles, you want each inner circle member to have a place in your life where he contributes without stepping on the other's toes. Second, you want inner circle members to make one another better, to raise one another's game. Sometimes that comes because they encourage one another. Sometimes it happens when they help one another by sharing information and wisdom. And sometimes it comes from friendly competition. No matter how it happens, if they improve the ability of other team members, they also improve your leaders. No leader starts out with a strong inner circle. When leaders take on new positions, they often have to build their inner circle from scratch. That was the case for me in 1981 when I accepted the offer to lead Skyline Church in San Diego, California. The church had a great history and nationally recognized reputation. It had been founded in the 1950s by Orville Butcher, a wonderful man, who was retiring after serving there for 27 years. Dr. Butcher had touched the lives of thousands of people with his leadership. It was a good church, but it did have one problem. It had not grown in years. One of the first things I did after taking the job was to meet with each staff member to assess individual abilities. Almost immediately, I discovered why the church had flatlined. The staff members were good people, but they were not strong leaders. No matter what I did with them, they would never be able to take the organization to the place we needed to go. In a church of that size, the staff is the leader's inner circle. If the staff is strong, then the leader can make a huge impact, but if the staff is weak, he can't. That's the law of the inner circle. The task that lay ahead of me was clear. I needed to remove the weak leaders and bring in better ones. That was the only way I would be able to turn the situation around. Mentally, I divided the people into three groups according to their ability to lead and deliver results. The bottom third I dismissed right away and began replacing them with the best people I could find. Then I began working on the middle third, and then what had been the top. The organization immediately began growing. By the end of 3 years, all but two of the original staff had been replaced by better leaders. Because the inner circle had gone to a new level, the organization was able to also go to a new level. Over the years, we tripled in size from 1,000 to more than 3,300 weekly attenders. The growth and success we experienced at Skyline were due to the law of the inner circle. When we had the right staff, our potential skyrocketed. And in 1995, when I left, other leaders from around the country sought to hire my key staff members for their organizations. They recognized the power of the law of the inner circle and wanted to hire the very best they could find to boost their potential. A leader's potential is determined by those closest to him. That's the law of the inner circle. That's the only way you can reach the highest level possible. Law number 12, the law of empowerment. Only secure leaders give power to others. Nearly everyone has heard of Henry Ford, the revolutionary automobile industry innovator and legend in American business history. In 1903, he co-founded the Ford Motor Company with the belief that the future of the automobile lay in putting it within reach of the average American worker. The Model T changed the face of the 20th century American life. By 1914, Ford was producing nearly 50% of all automobiles in the United States. The Ford Motor Company looked like an American success story. However, all of Ford's story is not about positive achievement, and one reason is that he didn't embrace the law of empowerment. Henry Ford was the antithesis of an empowering leader. He continually undermined his leaders and looked over the shoulders of his people. He even created a sociological department within Ford Motor Company to check up on his employees and direct their private lives. As time went by, he became more and more eccentric. He once went into his accounting office and tossed the company's books into the street, saying, "Just put all the money we take in a big barrel, and when a shipment of material comes in, reach into the barrel and take out enough money to pay for it." Perhaps Ford's most peculiar dealings were with his executives, especially his son Edsel. The younger Ford had worked at the company since he was a boy. As Henry became more eccentric, Edsel worked harder to keep the company going. If it weren't for Edsel, the Ford Motor Company probably would have gone out of business in the 1930s. Henry eventually gave Edsel the presidency of the company, but at the same time he undermined his son. Further, whenever a promising leader was rising up in the company, Henry tore him down. As a result, the company kept losing its best executives. The few who stayed did so because they figured that someday old Henry would die and Edsel would finally take over and set things right. But that's not what happened. In 1943, Edsel died at the age of 49. Edsel's oldest son, the 26-year-old Henry Ford II, quickly left the Navy so that he could return to Dearborn, Michigan, and take over the company. Young Henry was taking over a company that hadn't made a profit in 15 years. At that time, it was losing $1 million a day. The young president knew he was in over his head, so he set out to find leaders. Fortunately, the first group actually approached him. Colonel Charles Tex Thornton headed a team of 10 men who had worked together at the War Department during World War II. Their contribution to the Ford Motor Company was substantial. In the years to come, the group produced 6 company vice presidents and 2 presidents. The second influx of leadership came with the entrance of Ernie Breech, an experienced General Motors executive and the former president of Bendix Aviation. Young Henry hired him to be Ford's executive vice president, a position second to Henry's, with the expectation that he would take command and turn the company around. He succeeded. Breech quickly brought in more than 150 outstanding executives from General Motors, and by 1949, Ford Motor Company was on a roll again. In that year, the company sold more than 1 million Fords, Mercurys, and Lincolns, the best sales since the Model A. If Henry Ford II had lived by the law of empowerment, the Ford Motor Company might have grown enough to eventually overtake General Motors and become the number one car company again. But only secure leaders are able to give power to others, and Henry felt threatened. The success of Tex Thornton, Ernie Breech, and Louis Crusoe, a legendary GM executive whom Breech had brought into the company, made Henry worry about his own place at Ford. His position was based not on influence but on his name and his family's control of the company's stock. What was Henry's solution? He began pitting one top executive against another. Any time an executive gained power and influence, Henry undercut the person's authority by moving him to a position with less clout, supporting the executive's subordinates or publicly humiliating him. This maneuver continued all the days Henry II was at Ford. As one Ford president, Lee Iacocca, commented after leaving the company, "Henry Ford, as I would learn firsthand, had a nasty habit of getting rid of strong leaders." Iacocca says that Henry Ford II once described his leadership philosophy to him years before Iacocca himself became its target. Ford said, "If a guy works for you, don't let him get too comfortable. Don't let him get too cozy or set in his ways. Always do the opposite of what he expects. Keep your people anxious and off balance." Both Henry Fords failed to abide by the law of empowerment. Rather than identifying leaders, building them up, giving them resources, authority, and responsibility, and turning them loose to achieve, they alternately encouraged and undermined their best people. To lead others well, we must help them to reach their potential. That means being on their side, encouraging them, giving them power, and helping them to succeed. That's not traditionally what we're taught about leadership. What were the two leadership games we were taught as kids? King of the Hill and Follow the Leader. What was the object of King of the Hill? To knock other people down so that you could be the leader. And what was the point in Follow the Leader? You do the things you know followers can't do to separate yourself from them and make yourself look more powerful. The problem with these games is that to win, you have to make all the other people lose. The games are based on insecurity and are opposite of the way to raise up leaders. When I travel to developing countries, I am made especially aware of how alien the idea of empowerment can be to emerging leaders. In cultures where you have to fight to make something of yourself, the assumption often is that you need to fight others to maintain your leadership. But that reflects a scarcity mindset. The truth is that if you give some of your power away to others, there is still plenty to go around. When I teach the law of empowerment in emerging countries, I usually ask a volunteer to come up so that I can show visually what happens when a leader tries to keep others down instead of raising them up. I ask the volunteer to stand in front of me, and I put my hands on his shoulders. Then I begin pushing him down. The lower I want to push him, the more I have to bend down to do it. As I push him lower, I go lower. That's the same way it is in leadership. To keep others down, you have to go down with them. And when you do that, you lose any power to lift others up. When leaders fail to empower others, it's usually due to 3 main reasons. The number one barrier to empowerment, desire for job security. Weak leaders worry that if they help subordinates, they will themselves become dispensable. But the truth is that the only way to make yourself indispensable is to make yourself dispensable. In other words, if you're able to continually empower others and help them develop so that they can become capable of taking over your job, you will become so valuable to the organization that you become indispensable. That is the paradox of the law of empowerment. What if I work myself out of a job by empowering others, you may ask, and my superiors don't recognize my contribution? That can happen in the short term. But if you keep raising up leaders and empowering them, you will develop a pattern of achievement, excellence, and leadership that will be recognized and rewarded. If the teams you lead always seem to succeed, people will figure out that you are leading them well. The number two barrier to empowerment, resistance to change. By its very nature, empowerment brings constant change because it encourages people to grow and innovate. Change is the price of progress. That's not always easy to live with.